Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show dedicated to covering police-community relations in Portland and beyond. I'm Sam.
And I'm Jasmine. On today's show, we've got a look at the history of bargaining between the city and its police union, the PPA, and Sam chats with someone who was present at last week's standoff at the Hollywood Fred Meyer. But first, I've got a quick update on the CRC. The Citizen Review Committee held their regular meeting this month for the first time in a while, and on the agenda was a conference hearing on an appeal from a 2019 complaint involving a stolen vehicle. A conference hearing is the last stop before City Council and is a chance for the CRC to try to convince the Chief of Police of their position and vice versa. This was actually the second conference hearing on this complaint. The first took place in August of 2020 after the CRC found sufficient evidence to sustain the charge that the involved officer would not take a vehicle theft report from the appellant. Chief Lavelle, for his part, held that the officer should be exonerated. I know it's hard to imagine a more thrilling topic than a city meeting dealing with DMV forms, but stick with us because there's a little bit of meat on this bone. Way back in August of 2018, the appellant called the police to report that her car had been stolen. But she hadn't owned the car very long and didn't have the official title back from the DMV yet. Instead, she had a document indicating that her paperwork was in process. It was this document, the process document, that she provided to the responding officer as proof that she did in fact own the car. The officer, however, told her that the process document wasn't sufficient proof of ownership and refused to file a report on her behalf. As a result, when her car was recovered in a neighboring county, not only could officers not detain the person driving because there was no police report, but the appellant didn't have the opportunity to pick up her car before it was impounded. The impound lot eventually placed a lien on the vehicle for bills of over $1,000. Here is the appellant's advocate, TJ Browning, explaining what happened and the impact this had on the appellant.
I applaud all of you for saying that we have a victim here. We definitely do. She did what she was supposed to do. She called who she was supposed to call. She was not served, and the rest of us were not served in this circumstance either. And she is hoping that you all have the wisdom to fix it, or the power, or the chief does.
Chief Lavelle, while sympathetic to what the appellant had gone through, felt that holding the officer accountable was a bridge too far.
It's my belief that we have two competing statements from two credible parties. In this instance, I just feel it's hard to sustain the officer when the information he says he was provided would have led him to not take that stolen report.
The two credible stories that Chief Lavelle is talking about are, on the one hand, the appellant saying that she presented the officer with this process document, and on the other hand, the officer saying that she presented him with a handwritten bill of sale, which he did not deem to be sufficient proof of ownership of the vehicle. So the PPB position boiled down to this. It's impossible to know what happened, so let's not be too hasty. But as Browning pointed out, it's not, in fact, impossible to know what happened.
She turned in her handwritten bill of sale. And when the DMV sent it back, the date on that letter, which I gave to all of you at the first hearing, showed that she could not have handed over the bill of sale. She didn't have it.
Here is CRC member Sylvan Frazier with a little bit more on that point.
I find it a little bit disingenuous to say that that's like a legitimate credibility question and that they're on the same level credibility-wise if we have proof that she couldn't have had that document, which the officer in this case claims that he was shown. So I'm having trouble with those couple of things.
So despite the repeated assertions by TJ Browning and CRC members that there was in fact proof that the officer had lied about which documentation the appellant provided, Chief Lavelle held firm to his position that this was a question of policy. Andy Chiller, one of the longest serving members of the CRC, had this to say.
I think both the policy and holding officers accountable for their actions are what's important here. And I think the way that you affect change is to address both of those. I do think the policy could be clarified, but I also think that this officer did several things wrong. And I think should be accountable for those decisions. And I think those two things, those two prongs, both need to be addressed in order to affect change. Because you can talk about policy and you can talk about wording and you can talk about may or shall or what's initiate, and that's fine. But it doesn't matter if the officers aren't held accountable when they do something wrong.
In the end, the committee voted once again to sustain the allegation that the officer would not take a vehicle theft report from the appellant. The matter will now go to city council at some point in the coming months, and if they agree with the CRC, the officer could receive a stern talking to. We will be following up on this story and we'll keep you posted.
Last Tuesday, power outages resulted in many Portland-area grocery stores needing to get rid of perishable food. A standoff between employees at the Hollywood West Fred Meyer and people attempting to reclaim food from the store dumpsters escalated when management called the police. The resulting story and images of dumpsters filled with recently discarded food being protected by a line of armed police officers during a destructive winter storm and a housing crisis and a pandemic put Portland in the national spotlight again. The incident caught both Fred Meyer and the Portland Police Bureau on the back foot, and both released public statements explaining their actions. One of the people documenting the police presence at the scene was Dr. Juniper Simonis, an environmental biologist and data scientist who has tracked the use of chemical munitions by law enforcement in Portland with the Chemical Weapons Research Consortium. I spoke with Dr. Simonis last week about what they saw. This is edited for time, and the full version will be posted to the Totality of Circumstances show page at kboo.fm.
You know, like, the reason why I was there, right, is that folks made public that there were 9 store employees and only 3 people documenting them, not doing anything harassing, and then the police are getting called. And so in that situation, I am very keen to understand how the police respond tactically, but like specifically for me and my like research interests and stuff, like what weaponry do they bring? And so when I showed up, I wasn't even looking at the dumpsters. I was trying to figure out which cops these were, who was in charge, why were there so many, and what weapons they had, right? And so like I started asking them like for their cards, who to contact, for their names, for their numbers. I was just told, contact the PIO. And I was like, who's in charge here? And they weren't going to tell me. And then I was like, I went to this one officer. I was like, who was telling me to just go to the PIO. I wanted to know who that officer was so I could tell the PIO that that officer told me to contact them, right? Like, yeah. You know, following up with basic protocol. But that officer tried to hide his name and number and told me that he did not have to provide that information to me. I know it's private property, but like I'm just interacting with the police. I'm not talking to any Fred Meyer employees. I'm not looking at the dumpster. I'm not doing anything destructive or whatever, right? And so the police know because of that, that they literally have no authority over me. And so they go and get a store manager from like 50 feet plus away to come over and tell me without any interaction that I'm trespassing, right? Like, so he came over and told me, like, didn't ask me what I was doing, whatever. Like, as he was getting there, the words coming out of his mouth were, you're trespassing, leave, or you'll be arrested, right? And then that gave the cops the authority to actually enforce that. And so, like, I didn't want to get arrested for that. And I know it's private property, and legally they could have. And so I moved my car across the street, like, stood with the rest of the people that had, the 7 or 8 other people that had been told they were trespassing. And within, the amount of time that it took me to park my car and walk back over, the cops were leaving.
Dr. Simonis went back over to the parking lot after the police had left and took a look in the dumpsters.
Like I said, I didn't think I was going to be there for very long, but like peering over the green dumpster first, it was like a third full. It was a lot of cheese and yogurt, and it was all of the And it, like I said, it was about a third full. I could see that it was all food. And then I went over to the orange one and I stepped up on the side and I was just like, holy just the amount of food. They cleared out every single refrigerated or frozen space, including things that were refrigerated that don't need to be refrigerated, but are only kept cold because people like to buy them cold, like iced tea and cold brew.
To be clear, the store is open while all this is going on.
Totally. Yeah. And that's another thing, right? Like the police say in their statement that the power was out and the store was closed. No, that was open. Like I talked to one parent, like pushing a kid in a stroller, who was like, what's going on over there? And I explained sort of like what was happening. And they were like, cool, I'm going to go inside and get some milk. And then I'm going to come out and get some food. Because I think if I got food here first and then went inside, they'd be mad at me.
That was Dr. Juniper Simonis, part of the Chemical Weapons Research Consortium, speaking about what they saw last Tuesday when police responded to a Northeast Portland Fred Meyer to prevent people from taking discarded food from dumpsters during a widespread power outage. Tonight, we're taking a look at the history of labor negotiations between the City of Portland and the Portland Police Association. The current labor contract was only supposed to last until July 2020, but it was extended for another year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Later, we'll take a look at the city's primary demands in this round of bargaining, which follows several months of powerful protests against police racism and brutality following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May. Another layer of urgency is added by the passage of a ballot measure last year, which adds a new police oversight board to the city's charter. Fully implementing this board would require significant and overlapping changes to bureau policy, the police contract, and state law. Towards this end, the city has hired an outside negotiator for the first time ever, and has come out of the gate with some significant demands of the police union. Among these are allowing performance evaluations to include complaints made against the officer, removing the so-called embarrassment clause, and allowing the city to decide who disciplines officers. We'll hear more about the last two later in the show. The following historical overview is based on primary sources from the city archives, including old police contracts, as well as contemporary newspaper articles primarily from the Oregonian and the Oregon Journal. We've also referenced past and current reporting by KABU, the Portland Mercury, Portland Cop Watch, the Scanner, and the Portland Tribune. There is also an in-house history of the Portland Police Association called Pistols, Pickets, and Politics, written by Susan Hauser in the mid-90s, which we used to get the outline of some events, but which is largely based on anecdotal sources, private PPA archives, and publicly available news articles. The Portland Police Association was founded in 1942, and a year later was recognized as Local 456 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME. Today, it is the oldest continually operating police union in the United States, though far from the first. Police unions had a brief heyday in the early 20th century, but plunged into oblivion following the disastrous Boston police strike of 1919, when three-quarters of the Boston police force refused to work and the Massachusetts State Guard was called in to brutally suppress the population. Many localities banned police labor organizing after this, and large national organizations like the American Federation of Labor wanted nothing to do with the idea for decades and revoked the charters of existing unions. The organizing of what would become the PPA began in reaction to the then-police chief's drastic plans to force cops to work around the clock following the attack on Pearl Harbor. That policy died a quick death, but organizing continued around the perennial issues of wages, benefits, and job security, all of which were at the whim of police management and the city budget process. During the 27 years after its founding and before the city agreed to recognize the union as a bargaining unit, the PPA president would propose wage increases to the city council, but beyond that could do little more than ask nicely, beg, cajole, and try to rally public support. Before 1969, the Portland Police Association really did not have that much power in the city compared to its clout today. But in that period it gained some wage increases, time and a half for overtime, and fiercely defended its jurisdiction by advocating against alternatives to sworn, armed cops. But all of its wins were singular and reversible, and depended on strong voices and union leadership finding sympathetic ears in city government and the media. In 1968, the year before contract bargaining attracted the majority of the union's energy, the PPA's loudest campaign was against a plan by Chief Donald McNamara to hire 6 black patrolmen on a temporary, provisional basis. The union claimed that this was not due to any racist feeling among officers, but because the plan would circumvent the city's civil service testing requirements. And it wasn't like the Bureau had a great record of recruitment among the black community either, with just 7 black officers in 1968 out of 715 total officers. Quotes from Bureau brass in this time period show that they well understood the unpopularity of police work in the city's black community, but largely shrugged off the challenge of making a connection. McNamara's plan resulted in just 1 black officer being hired on the temporary basis, and then quitting when he encountered, quote, personal difficulties, some of which were racially inspired, end quote, in the words of the Oregonian. According to a retrospective article in 1971, there was no significant follow-up to this plan, and hiring of black officers remained stagnant and low. In November of 1968, the City Council voted to begin recognizing bargaining units of city employees. The PPA at that time represented just 1 of several sectors of city employees who applied for recognition and began preparing for their first ever round of labor contract negotiations. These first negotiations dragged on well into 1970, but won cops significant and retroactive pay raises. While the 1970s saw a few hard-fought bargaining sessions, the biggest changes to the contract itself were mostly confined to wages and benefits, where the union has always had a talent for leveraging increases. But other changes occurred away from the bargaining table. In 1975, then-union president Stan Peters convinced the union membership to drastically increase its input on city politics by giving regular candidate endorsements and political donations. This became enshrined in the basic identity of the PPA, and the union continues to be politically active to this day. The union's leadership manages the political action committee Keep Portland Safe, which most recently donated tens of thousands of dollars in 2020 to an unsuccessful opponent of Multnomah County's relatively progressive district attorney, Mike Schmidt. The union also wields statewide lobbying power via the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs, ORCOPS, which is also led by PPA's own leadership. The lobbyist employed by ORCOPS, Michael Salvaggio, routinely appears at state legislative hearings to argue against police reform measures. In this way, the PPA has been able to wield influence over officer working conditions and citizens' living conditions outside of the labor contract. Getting back to the main thread, the late 1970s and early 80s saw the rise of the union's innovative and aggressive use of arbitration, both to overturn discipline and to win concessions from the city in bargaining sessions. Both strategies were pioneered by the PPA's lawyer, Will Acheson, who has become a national authority on public safety labor relations. Acheson literally wrote the book, or at least a book, on interest arbitration, the kind that deals with union contracts. In 1984, and then again in 1988, arbitrator decisions won wage increases for the union after the city had asked for a pay freeze because of budget deficits. These victories enamored the PPA to many other city workers due to so-called Me Too clauses in city union contracts. If one union negotiated a pay hike, others would get a raise too. The other kind of arbitration, grievance arbitration, the kind that got Ron Frashauer reinstated, has been enshrined in the police contract since 1969, but also came into its own in the 1980s through the union's aggressive defense of officers accused of racist behavior. We've covered this in greater detail before, which you can find on our show page at kboo.fm. A case in point would be the killing of Tony Stevenson in 1985 by Officer Gary Barber. Barber, a white cop, put Stevenson, a black veteran assisting 7-Eleven staff with a possible shoplifter, in a chokehold, resulting in his death later that night. KBOO reported at the time on what happened next.
After the death of Lloyd Stevenson, the use of the carotid or chokehold was suspended by Police Chief Penny Harrington. That angered some police officers. Officers Richard Monty and Paul Wickersham decided to do something. They had printed up dozens of T-shirts with the insignia, "Don't choke 'em, smoke 'em." Smoke 'em is police slang for shooting. Monty and Wickersham then began selling the T-shirts out of the trunk of a car parked at the East Precinct Police Station, Chief Harrington's old precinct. 20 to 30 of the T-shirts were sold to an unknown number of Portland police officers. Community reaction was angry and swift. Ron Herndon, co-chair of the Black United Front.
This is almost what you would expect to find from police hit squads in El Salvador. I'm dead serious. That's the kind of mentality you get from police hit squads.
Police Chief Penny Harrington reassigned Monty and Wickersham to desk duty. Then, after an all-day hearing in private on Monday, Mayor Bud Clark, the police commissioner, announced he was firing the two officers for selling the T-shirts.
We have a fine police bureau. Unfortunately, as in every large organization, a few people can smear the image of what is generally a fine organization.
Herb Cawthorn of the Urban League praised the firings as a wonderful action. Other public reaction was equally positive. But the president of the police officers' union, Stan Peters, said that although the officers were wrong to sell the T-shirts, firing them was excessive. The firings will be appealed to a labor arbitrator. In a similar incident 3 years ago, two fired police officers were reinstated by a labor arbitrator.
Sure enough, Monty and Wickersham were reinstated with back pay, and Barber remained on the force, patrolling the streets of Portland, until 2013. Another tactic that came into its own in the 1980s involved the union suing to put a hold on public policies that might affect police working conditions, so that those policies could be negotiated behind closed doors during the next bargaining sessions. One popular proposal that was watered down to nothing in this way was a 1983 ballot measure that would have required public employees to live in the city of Portland. This was vigorously opposed by the PPA, which asked the courts to prevent the city from implementing the residency policy, so it would have time to overturn the policy during bargaining. The rationale for this came from the police contract itself, which said that any measures affecting working conditions would be subject to the bargaining process. The PPA won that fight, too. And today, fewer than 50% of Portland police officers actually live here. Last week, I spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch about bargaining in the 1990s and 2000s, and about some of the measures the city has taken in this current round of negotiations to get the upper hand, or at least level the playing field, with its police union.
We're not included in any way in the bargaining sessions in the first decade or so. And then sometime in the 2000s, they decided to open up some of the bargaining sessions every other session to the public. And what turned out happened was that they did most of the bargaining about things the public was interested in, like oversight and accountability, in the private sessions, and the stuff about, you know, wages and vacation time, things like that, which are interesting and, you know, impact us as taxpayers and so forth, but not one of the reasons that we're involved as a police accountability group. So they did all that behind closed doors at the PPA headquarters. And that happened in two separate iterations of the negotiations. Then in 2016, we're working with other organizations throughout the time, but in that particular year, we worked with the NAACP and the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, and sent a letter to City Council in August anticipating the June 2017 expiration date, and said we would like to make sure that you include these important concepts when you're negotiating with the police association. And the next month, the finished contract was presented to City Council to vote on, because they had already, Charlie Hales had already started the negotiations and completed them, unbeknownst to us, more drafting up the letter. This was way before the contract was even going to expire. And so that entire session was closed to the public. And then last year, they set up to have public negotiations every other session. Again, had two public sessions where there were hammer and ground rules, one public session or one private session at the police association headquarters where we and other allies held a picket line outside their headquarters, and then shut the whole thing down.
This year, the city has sort of made what I believe is the unprecedented step of hiring a third-party labor negotiator?
Yeah, no, that's never happened before.
From what you've observed, do you think that that will make a significant difference?
Well, we don't know what the end product is going to look like. Certainly in terms of how the negotiations have started this year. Last year, we didn't, you know, they didn't get past the ground rule, so it was hard to know what was going to happen. But basically, they kind of laid out on the table a lot of concerns the community had, that the city is asserting that they have the right to decide who does the investigations, which presumably means also including deadly force cases. They get to decide who does the disciplining, which is something that the new oversight system that was that the new board is going to have the power to discipline. I mean, assuming that there aren't other hurdles other than the contract, because that's what the city is saying they're going to have. Now, nobody knows what's going to happen at the end, like I said, because if the city has one version of a contract and the union has, I use that term loosely, the union has another one, and they can't come to an agreement, then an arbitrator gets to decide which contract to go with. So it's not like a middle ground or a negotiation or a mediation that goes on. It's like one contract or the other. So if it ends up in mediation or in the arbitration and the PBA prevails, then all these efforts by the outside attorney are for naught. What we've learned in the past, the $9 million that I mentioned before that the TPA got out of the city to get rid of the 48-hour rule is kind of where their hearts are, that they're looking out for the bottom line for themselves and their members. So if the city had something to give them financially, they might be willing to give up some of these things, but there might be, you know, just a place where they're not willing to go. And
on that list of things that the city was asking for was allowing the city to decide who disciplines officers. And I had some trouble finding a specific clause or series of clauses that prevents the city from doing that in the contract.
I do not know where that is based. Here's my interpretation, how we've interpreted that at Cop Watch, and it relates to our current oversight system. What the contract does say is that when an officer is being investigated for misconduct, the city has to tell them the name and rank of the officer doing the investigation. That implies that the investigation is being done by somebody within the bureau. The interviews have to happen within a police bureau building. So at this point, when independent police review, so-called, is doing their independent investigations of misconduct cases, A, they have to happen inside a police facility, and B, there has to be somebody from the police bureau there to order the officer to answer the question, because the IPR is not part of the police bureau. They're not in the chain of command, and they cannot compel the officer to testify. So I think when the IPR was trying to overcome that and ask the city to change their the city code that allows them to do these investigations so that they can compel officer testimony, what ended up happening is they backed down and came up with this cockamamie system where, the IPR has to count on internal affairs to compel the officers to testify because, again, going all the way up the chain of command to the chief and then to the police commissioner, the IPR is underneath the auditor, and so they don't have power directly over these employees. So I think it's all related back to that, like who disciplines them relates back to that. However, what the IPR was trying to rely on was a power that is invested right now in the Bureau of Human Resources. So regardless of which bureau you're in, the Bureau of Human Resources can do an investigation on you and discipline you. So it seems to me that there is probably a loophole that can be opened up so that the new system can be given a similar power to that.
I've been speaking with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. Dan, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
You can also find the full version of that interview at kboo.fm.
That's it for this month's Totality of Circumstances. Catch us on the last Tuesday of every month from 5:30 to 6 at 90.7 FM or on the web at kboo.fm.
You can email us with questions or comments at totalityradio@gmail.com. That's totalityradio, all one word, @gmail.com. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting KBOO Portland, your community radio station. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Sam. Good night.
listen.